Again, Keep Nestle Out of the Gorge is a good website. Springhouse Cellars at 6 p.m. tonight in Hood River, localwateralliance.org. That's all you need to know. And hope to see you out there. And stay tuned next week for another program. And stay tuned for Political Perspectives here on KBOO Community Radio. My name is Paul Rowland. This has been Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you so much for listening.
We're dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations, dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations, dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Ha, 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 ha. Say goodbye to plastic and goodbye to cars. No more convenience stores. Hello to stars. No more Wall Street and no more Pentagon. Thinking about these things makes me happy.
Jim Pepper Native Arts Festival, September 26th, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. at the Park Rose High School West Athletic Field in Portland. The Jim Pepper Native Arts Festival remembers and celebrates the art, music, personality, and legacy of the great Kaw Creek musician Jim Pepper. This year's performers include One Heart, featuring Jan Michael Looking Wolf, the Delbert Anderson Trio, Four Directions Drum, Big B, and many more. Again, that's the third annual Jim Pepper Native Arts Festival, September 26th, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. at the Park Rose High School West Athletic Field, 12003 Northeast Shaver Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The fourth Monday of each month at 11:30 a.m. to Voices for the Animals.
We discuss the latest news and trends in the animal world
and the role of activism surrounding the issues of animal rights.
That's Voices for the Animals at 11:30 a.m. on the fourth Monday of each month on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Buffalo Field Campaign 2015 Roadshow, hosted Wednesday, September 23rd at 7 p.m. at Bison Coffee House in Portland. The event will feature stories and songs about the last wild buffalo and information about the ongoing struggle to protect them. That's the Buffalo Field Campaign 2015 Roadshow, Wednesday, September 23rd, 7 p.m. at the Bison Coffee House, 3941 Northeast Cully Boulevard in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. This is Patsy Kullberg. It's KBOO. You're listening to KBOO Portland, and it is Wednesday, September 23rd. Coming up this morning on the Boo at 9, we speak with Brad Evans about his book, Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle, co-authored with Henry Giroux. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints explores the secret government of the United States with noted investigative reporter David Talbot and professor, author, and investigative historian Peter Dale Scoot. And at 11, on the Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter speaks with author Janet Cascadia about her visionary novel, The Tyranny of Psychopaths. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support in our membership drive last week. If you missed it, it's not too late. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. It is 904 KBOO, Portland. Next up, Brad Evans.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for Political Perspectives. My guest is Dr. Brad Evans. He is a political philosopher, critical theorist, and writer with a specialty in the problem of violence. He is the author of some 10 books and edited volumes, along with over 40 academic and media articles. He currently serves as a senior lecturer at the School of Sociology, Politics, and International Studies, the University of Bristol in the UK. Brad Evans is founder director of the Histories of Violence Project, and he is currently leading a global research initiative on the theme of disposable life to interrogate the meaning of mass violence in the 21st century. His latest book is Disposable Futures: The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle, written with Henry Giroux, published by City Lights this year. He joins us now by phone from the UK. Brad Evans, thanks very much for being on KBOO Radio.
It's my pleasure. Thanks very much for inviting me.
We're going to be talking about some of the ideas in Disposable Futures. I'd like to start by asking you what you mean by disposability, especially as we look at and listen to the current news reports on the migrant crisis in Europe. I think might be a way to kind of get into that topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the very recent imagery of the very tragic imagery of the little boy Alien, which showed up right across the world, really is perhaps a very clear example of what we're trying to explain with this concept of disposability. Now, I'm obviously coming at the problem that we're trying to engage with from a clearly political perspective, and we're all too aware within political discourse and language of quite prominent and accepted categories such as freedom, security, justice, rights, and there isn't, enough engagement perhaps with the raw realities of power and given, sufficient conceptual vocabulary to do justice to those terms. So myself and Henry tried to put forward this idea of disposability as a way to understand those conditions which give rise to the disposability of human lives in the 21st century. How do we account for, what should be ultimately intolerable conditions to us? And in that sense, for us, the vocabulary of disposability points to a very distinct systemic problem, which raises fundamental questions around responsibility, culpability, and around to try to make sense more clearly of the politics of tragedies that we see on a daily basis. And I think part of the problem that we certainly encountered in modern societies is how the reality of everyday violence can somehow get very blurred and making it very difficult for us to even make sense of problems, let alone respond to them. So for us, using the term of disposability is one way of trying to connect individual disasters and catastrophes to the systems which produce them, such that we can have a much more broader and serious conversation, for instance, in terms of the tragic image of the little boy who was washed up on the beach. Who is actually responsible for his death? Where does culpability lie? How can we understand this in a much more broader historical context? And how do we act upon this in a way which doesn't simply just parcel the problem in very neat and overtly politicized ways?
And can you talk about what the cultural forces are, the political forms, so to speak, that are acting upon us as we look at that image of a little boy on a beach, and what kind of forces we are dealing with there?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think to make sense of this, and I think when we look at that image of the boy, first of all, I think that there's something quite important to maybe, to try to address in terms of why was it that image has become so symbolic and other images haven't become symbolic. And we can, of course, say that we can relate to the image in a really visceral and personal way and perhaps the real power of the politics of aesthetics is the way in which it can sometimes really capture the people's imagination and really bring forward the raw realities of intolerable conditions for people. But of course, what should be apparent to us is this image is one of many other catastrophes and images which don't kind of make it through. And there was, you know, only last week that the case in Europe where, you know, a van was found with 71 corpses inside. You know, there was no photographs, there was no imagery, but it was equally as tragic and equally as disturbing. And why is it that certain, I guess, images kind of break through and others don't, is in itself perhaps an important thing to consider. And I think part of, to understand this more broadly, maybe we need to engage with precisely what we call the spectacle of violence in the book. And in that sense, and I guess a particular element of the spectacle of violence that we try to deal with is that, on the one hand, we can kind of say in modern societies and in our liberal societies that we're kind of awash with representations of violence. And we only have to turn on the news or indeed, you know, pick up the latest sort of technological phone devices now, which quite literally put the world in your hand. We're saturated by proliferations of catastrophe and images of disaster, and which can kind of make the whole sort of process in itself seem overwhelming to us. But on the other hand, there is still a strong mediation in the aesthetics and discourses of suffering. We are, you know, there is this ongoing politicization of what actually gets recorded as a life worth, you know, recording in death and others which are not. And it sometimes takes an overwhelming force of catastrophe for us to actually act upon this. And in that sense, why do we need to wait for it to become so exceptional before we actually deal with, you know, what is quite clearly a much more prolonged historic tragedy?
And so a little bit more about this spectacle, this politics of spectacle. Talk a little bit more about that and how that is affecting all of us. What are some other aspects of the politics of spectacle about how we are surrounded by spectacle? Can you do that, please?
Yeah, sure. Well, one of the points that we try to make in the book, and this draws from a much broader set of literatures, which have kind of been, you know, in circulation for some considerable time, is that the spectacle in certainly post sort of late 1960s has increasingly become a force which kind of shapes all social relations. And there is certainly a very technological aspect to this. For those of us who live in advanced liberal societies, or if you want to call them advanced, but certainly technologically accessible to advanced technologies, that there has been a proliferation of these new media technologies in which the spectacle itself can become very defining. And we're very aware of this idea of societies being image conscious, but I think the new modern technologies actually make us very clearly image conscious. And I can find this and relate to this very clearly, just in terms of pedagogy, when you engage with students, there is a very clear sense of the importance of image consciousness for them. But the spectacle, in that sense, of course, works by, you know, fixing people's gazes on particular problems. Now, relating this to the problem of violence, it seems very clear to us that the spectacle works in a very clear and overtly politicized way. And when we're talking about the spectacles of violence in the book in particular, what we're very much interested in is less the technological, although the technology is an enabler, but how do we understand the politics of the spectacle of violence? Now, on the one hand, again, we can kind of say that in many senses, this is not radically new, because what makes all political violence political as such is that it demands an audience. There needs to be, you know, the audience which is witness. But part of the issue that we face in the contemporary societies is that we're all now forced witness to historical events which sometimes appear beyond our control. And we are bombarded with daily images and representations of violence which not only blur the lines between, you know, responsibility, culpability, and indeed where the problematic appears in the first place, but also onto more, I think, more fundamental questions of, you know, what is actually being seen and what is not being seen in the modern societies. And this idea of the spectacle of violence then for us is very problematic because it blurs the distinction between what is real, what is unreal, and also some of the ways in which societies promote spectacles of violence and the ways in which spectacles of violence are presented to us has something of the pornographic in it as well. And there is almost like a banalization of representations of violence. And certainly one of the points that we try to make in the book, is that one of the most significant challenges that we face today in the age of this proliferation of representations of violence is how can we develop a proper ethical pedagogical awareness of the subject of violence that does the subject proper. And what we mean by that is that how can we start to engage with images like we see from everywhere, from the little boy turning up on the street, on the beach, sorry, to the ongoing violence against black people in the United States of America. How can we start to recognize the ethical significance of those representations of violence that kind of moves beyond some of the crass reductionism of much of the debate?
Right, and that is a question I have, is are there certain things we should be aware of when we are watching these aspects of spectacle to try to discern things that are happening and what could be ethical and what's not?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a real important fundamental interplay here in terms of the way the spectacle is narrated. And images and representations of violence in themselves are only important in so much as there's a truth ascribed to them. And in that sense, that's where the mediation of violence and the mediation of suffering happens. Now, you can kind of see this very evidently in the context, certainly of the United States of America, the way in which post 9/11, which of course was the most horrific spectacle of violence, how a very complex event and a very complex and deeply tragic moment in American history was almost immediately ascribed a very singular truth and a very singular narrative. And that in itself brings us directly, of course, to the overt politicization. Now, in that context, of course, what happens was there was quite clearly a political interpretation of the events applied. And in that sense, the political interpretation of events not only ends up putting an entire people on trial, but, of course, an entire religion in the context of Islam. And you also find this happening in, time and time again, whenever there's some form of spectacle of violence which is related in an Islamic context. And there is that sense of the immediate criticism of a particular system or a particular idea or a particular ideology. In contrast to that, of course, as I'm sure you're all too aware in the context of the United States of America, the recent massacre in Charleston, where in that case there's another outburst of violence, a clear attempt to make violence very spectacular. But in that sense, the systemic is altogether divorced, and it's actually reduced to questions of individual pathology. So there's not a people put on trial, or there's not a religion put on trial in that context, Christianity. It's just simply the lone wolf attacker. And in that sense, it's how we ascribe truths to spectacles of violence, which in themselves then reveal the politics.
Is there a historical difference in this way that we ascribe truth to violence? I know that you have talked about the fact that recent commemorations, including World War II and Hiroshima, bring up questions of what mass violence might mean in the 21st century now as compared to the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. In terms of looking back over the Disposable Futures book, and indeed the broader Disposable Life project I'm working on, was really an attempt to rethink mass violence in the 21st century. And there's been a great deal of commemoration over the past couple of years around what's been rightly termed the century of violence. But even then, when we look back at the histories of truth ascribed to the previous century of violence, tends to be very overtly politicized in a way such that it's often presented, for instance, that liberalism, which is kind of coextensive with what we might call neoliberalism today, simply defeated ideological fascism, and for that matter, defeated communism as well. And in that sense, then, there was the prevailing of justice, security, rights, freedom, and all those fundamental categories which every single political project makes claim to. Now, it's by narrating the past in those ways that we certainly profess our civilizational claims in the present. And yet, if we look at the history of the entire liberal encounter, it's been proliferated with experiences of violence. And there is certainly, there's nothing to say that liberalism in it either is in any less capable of being prone to fascistic tendencies. So I think we need to kind of move beyond, first of all, that historical understanding of simply our regimes are less violent than others, because the empirical evidence alone certainly doesn't, you know, suggest that. And of course, Hiroshima and Nagasaki are perhaps the most obvious and glaring examples of this. And what we kind of find, and this is something which I take a lot for in terms of the work of Zygmunt Bauman, whose wonderful book, first of all, Modernity and the Holocaust, onto his more contemporary stuff in terms of dealing with ideas of liquid terror in society and the siege, when he talks quite explicitly around the failure to learn the lessons of the past and the failure to still believe in the virtues of instrumental rationality, how there is an inherent danger in our civilizational claims. And Bauman's, I guess, fundamental message is that, for the most part, mass violence and atrocity is actually not committed by irrational monsters. It's reasoned, calculated, and justified for all too clear civilizational claims of security, rights, and justice. We saw that so evident with the wars and terror, and we continue to see that evident in the world today.
Are there examples of ethical representations of violence that you can point to?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think one of the things we need to try to avoid here is certainly trying to provide this as a definitive blueprint of how we can be ethical. And I do think it's something which is developing. But there are breakthrough moments, and even. Sometimes it's tempting to even see the media, first of all, as some homogenized monolithic block. But even in terms of much of the reporting actually throughout the United Kingdom in the last couple of days around the migrant crisis has actually been quite remarkably humbling in terms of the way that even the media can sometimes realize that enough's enough and that they've kind of caught onto the spirit of this, even though certainly there's still a debate raging in the United Kingdom between the British Broadcast Corporation, for instance, reluctance to use the term refugee instead of a migrant. More broadly, in terms of one of the things we try to do actually right throughout the book is that in each of the chapters, at the end of each chapter, we try to end on providing positive examples from uses of media onto popular culture of ways in which we can see ethical engagements with the problem of violence in meaningful and critical ways. As I say, we give a number of examples in terms of certain media cases, in terms of certainly the engagement with the Black Lives Movement, but also onto a number of cases in terms of popular culture. And we've both been even drawn to the HBO series The Wire, which I think even in that sort of very sometimes standardized format, you have remarkable cases of resistance, and I think The Wire in itself was really pushed forward the idea that that we should be able to think about representations of violence in much more complex, less moralizing terms, and of course to actually give voice to what Paulo Freire would call the pedagogy by the oppressed. And to my mind, The Wire in particular was one of the first examples of actually giving voice to young Black youths to talk about their plight and their problems. So in that sense, I think there's always resistance within the system, and it's to harness that as being forms of ethical breakthroughs.
I'm speaking with Brad Evans. He is the co-author with Henry Giroux of Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle. And if I can mention the cover of the book, Brad, the image is quite haunting on the cover. Trying to describe it, you might do a better job than I do, but it's a water scene, actually, it appears to be, with sort of businessmen-looking like figures who gradually become submerged in the water until some of the figures you can only see the very top of their bald heads, and there are quite a few of them. Do you want to say anything about that and how it relates to the concepts in Disposable Futures?
Mm-hmm. Well, the image you refer to is actually it's by an artist called Isaac Cordell, and it's aptly titled Follow the Leaders. Now, Cordell's work is often associated actually with the politics of climate change, and you can immediately recognize that from the cover. But we decided to use the image because we thought actually it connected much more broadly to what we believe are the normalization of dystopian narratives. And the way I think the image itself forces us to cover, you know, to address fundamental questions around memory, the political agency, and also what does it mean to bear witness to this idea of the coming catastrophe. And one of the, I guess, the final chapter of the book, which really connects back to the work of Cordell, which I think is very much evident in the cover, is the claim that we're making now is if the violence of the 20th century was to be understood through the problem of utopia, in so much as there was a logic of utopia which gave rise to sometimes really horrifying and catastrophic political projects, such that entire populations became disposable in the name of progress, we're in an entirely different political moment. And that political moment, I guess, puts forward a different logic of nihilism. It's no less nihilistic than some of the 20th century projects, but it's a nihilism based on dystopian realism. And the image, I believe, of the cover certainly encapsulates that, that we now live in this age of dystopian realism, where we are now taught to believe that our systems are fundamentally insecure by design. This in itself offers a fundamental departure, and indeed, you could argue, underwrites completely the very idea of the social, of the state. What is the sovereign state if it's not to provide security for its citizens? But we are now told time and time again that some form of catastrophe is now inevitable, that we have to accept that the future, in fact, is going to be an endemic terrain of catastrophes, that there are many things we simply cannot overcome, as Frederick Jameson points out, and we cite this in the book. Why is it that it's easier to now imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism? And these are the types, I guess, of questions that we're trying to deal with in the book. And it does take you into, I guess, a lot of ethically and politically fraught terrain. On the one hand, you know, what we are dealing with here is, what does it mean to live in societies where catastrophe is normalized, where it becomes inevitable, where we actually accept without question that we are simply born to be vulnerable? And one of the things that inevitably does is it can kind of flatten vulnerability. It can say that actually race, gender, class are no longer of significance because we're all vulnerable in this. And that's one of the problems. But we also find a horrifying mimeticism with this as well. And there's no clearer, and we talk about this in the final chapter of the book, there's no clear indication that we're living in this dystopian realism age than the horrifying mimeticism of the violence of ISIS, which mimic the logic of our system but take it to the nth degree, harnessing the power of the spectacle, turning it back on itself, and really pushing forward a different form of nihilism, which actually mirrors the logic of the system, doesn't contrast with it. And that is something which should warn us more than anything else.
Yeah, you make the point throughout the book that there's this whole issue of, because militarization and violence are so normalized and warfare is so normalized, I guess would be the word, that there's the inability to tell whether we are at war or not at war.
Mm. Yeah, well, I think it's worth kind of dating this to, again, back to the events of 9/11, because it became quite common in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 to write about, and a lot of authors did this, to write about the politics of exceptionalism. And what they meant by that was, you know, that 9/11 in itself was a very exceptional event, an exceptional spectacle of violence. Tony Blair said, you know, it's the day the world changes forever. You have then this narrative which comes through that because the United States of America is an exceptional power, it can operate outside of international law, therefore you have an exceptional response, which will lead eventually to the exceptional abuse of power, as many critics kind of wrote of, in terms of, you know, everything from Guantanamo Bay to Abu Ghraib and so on and so forth. Now, I think whilst those types of narratives are quite seductive in terms of pointing to these specific moments in history, on the one hand, I don't think, and this is something we try to talk about in the book, the United States of America's response, first of all, to 9/11 wasn't in any way exceptional. It was actually altogether expected. And it actually was business as usual, if we follow the money of the violence. And in, you know, doing nothing after 9/11 would have been an exceptional politics. But what we find was really the continuation of the normalization of military responses to global problems, and hence the perpetuation of the cycle of violence. But alongside this, and going back to your point as well, is that what we have found certainly, and this has been slowly maturing for some time, but it certainly starts to accelerate with the collapse of the Berlin Wall, and in the age where power has now been all divorced from the modern nation state for many senses, is that in the age of this normalization of violence, where we're in a condition perhaps of unending war and violence, all the once familiar modern demarcations that we kind of took for granted, which were again enshrined in the modern nation state between times of war, times of peace, who were friends, who were enemies, what was the inside of the realm, what was the outside of the realm, all those things have now entered into the Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben has called a zone of indistinction, where we no longer have a clear sense anymore of, are we still at war? We no longer know. The fact that nobody actually seems to even talk about the war on terror anymore doesn't mean it's gone away. It just means it's normalized. We no longer have any clear set coordinates around who is a friend or who is an enemy. That doesn't mean to say that we feel any more secure. On the contrary, we arouse suspicions around everyone. How else can we account for the heightened surveillance technologies? And this new age then of dystopian, what we call dystopian realism, where all these demarcations have collapsed, really force us to rethink the very contours of politics, ethics, and justice in the 21st century. And we're only starting to grasp the importance of those conversations. And one of the real dangers for all of this is that we simply retreat back into 20th century paradigms. And we see this happening right across continental Europe with the rise of state forms of fascism. We can also, of course, see this in, once again, the rise of religious movements who kind of provide the security and sense of belonging that the modern nation state used to do. But we know the catastrophic outcomes of these. So part of the fundamental challenge we face in the 21st century is to develop an adequate politics and ethics, which is attuned to our age. And I don't think there are any 20th century solutions to 21st century problems. We have to move forward. And that certainly doesn't mean on the left even reviving old, outdated concepts, and certainly not communism with all the violence that was associated with that as well.
So is that where some kind of new educational process comes into play?
Mm. Absolutely. And this is why I've always in particular been taken by the work of Henry and his commitment to the value of critical pedagogy, which is very humbling and points to, I guess, to an entire career of work. Now, the one thing which I've always taken from Henry's work is precisely the understanding that education is always a form of political intervention. It's always about inscribing forms of agency and inscribing forms of subjectivity. And there's no greater task for me as an educator, and this is what I've taken from Henry, which goes back also to the work of Paulo Freire. There is no greater task for us as educators than to instill a critical ethic amongst our students. Because if we are to challenge and reshape the future, what we really need to do is harness the power of imagination. And this can far too often be lost once we start reducing politics to pure instrumental inquiry, instrumental reason, when everything becomes purely positivist scientific investigations. What we need to do, and this is certainly where, if we are looking for future sites of resistance, it needs to begin now with education at the youngest ages. And in that sense, it is all about instilling the value of critical pedagogy, the virtues of the humanities, the virtues of the arts, and getting people to ask difficult questions about the world. Of course, sometimes there are no more difficult questions to ask than by providing new angles of vision on the problem of violence, and that's perhaps what we try to do with this book. But education has to be the start point for rethinking what the political means in the 21st century. It's perhaps not up to our generation to do that, and it's certainly not for our generation to impose a blueprint on that, but it's certainly to give younger people the confidence that they can transform the world for the better. I think if we, again, link this back to the wars on terror, of course, we all know that every war produces its casualties. But there's been, perhaps from our perspective, no greater casualty for us than the intellectual casualties. And that casualty is this idea that we can now transform the world for the better. Rescuing something of that, I think, has to be one of the most fundamental challenges that we face in the 21st century.
You're saying that the idea that we can make a change for the better? Is that that's we're trying to develop that and trying to let people know that that is possible? That is a challenge? Is that what you're saying?
It's both a challenge and an obligation. So I think the impotence is already there for, you know, I'm always heartened that the start of every academic year when a new cohort of students comes in. And despite how horrible the world might seem sometimes, there's always a sense of optimism with them. There's always a sense that, you know, that the world can be changed. And it seems part of the failure, perhaps, of an academic system sometimes is that that can be gradually ground out of people. And we need to retain some of that optimism. And again, I think this is where, you know, Henry's broader work, when he focuses on, you know, the politics of youth, is important. Because the one thing that we find with, if we look at, you know, youths as having very clear and serious forms of political agency, is that they're wonderfully creative. They're wonderfully vibrant. And they do have this idealism and this confidence that the world can be changed for the better. And they want to do it on their terms. And that is something which perhaps older generations perhaps need. You know, whilst it's good for us to provide pedagogical awareness and philosophical advices to, you know, the violence of history and certain warnings, it's perhaps up to future generations to create the political on their own terms. And that is, and if we lose that, then all that prevails is nihilism. If we give up on the idea that all we're forced to do is endure endemic states of catastrophe and that we cannot face the future with confidence, then I think the battle's already lost.
I'm speaking with Brad Evans. We're talking about some of the ideas in his latest book, written jointly with Henry Giroux. The book is Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of the Spectacle. And we haven't mentioned too much about neoliberalism, but it does underlie the concepts in the book. And I wanted to ask you about who is served by disposable futures, who is served by spectacle and violence as spectacle. Can you talk a little bit about that and how neoliberalism comes into play?
Yeah, I think there's obviously a lot written about neoliberalism, and much of it can actually be quite abstract. And what we try to do, certainly in the book, is to approach the problem of neoliberalism as an actual and existing regime of power. And in that sense, neoliberalism, whilst it's certainly driven by the marketization and the commodification of everything, so there's a clear economic driver, and in many ways, the economic subsumes the political, the cultural, the social, the philosophical, and whatever else they want to absorb into its universe, it still retains those elements. So there is a politics to neoliberalism, there's a culture to neoliberalism, there's a philosophy to neoliberalism. And in that sense, it's all about creating a systemic logic, which is not homogenized in its operations and effects, but is actually very contingent. It can operate in different circumstances in different ways, to the hollowing out of political alternatives. And that is one of the, you know, one of the defining elements, as I see, of neoliberalism, is precisely the ability to suffocate political resistance very clearly, and often actually in ways that commodifies it and absorbs it within its system. Now, in terms of who are the winners and losers of neoliberalism, on the one hand, we could, you know, conduct a very straightforward economic inquiry, and there's been ample studies done on in terms of who are the straightforward economic winners and who are the disposable populations of neoliberalism. And I was recently watching an interview by Slavoj Žižek where he talks about recent studies done about the operations of neoliberalism today, which effectively only requires for it to operate now around 20% of the world's population. And the other 80% of the world's population is effectively disposable or redundant to what it needs to do. And even within that 20%, we're all very much aware of who are the beneficiaries. Who, you know, in an age of austerity, of course, the wealthy of every given nation, their wealth has increased exponentially. And in that sense, this again raises fundamental questions around architectures of power. Now, once we start engaging with neoliberalism at the level of power, this raises, you know, issues first of all about its location. And the one thing which seems quite evident to me, at least, is that when we talk about power today, it's preposterous to simply talk about it in nation-state or sovereign terms. Power has long since evacuated the modern nation-state. And in fact, the nation-state just simply appears to me and to my St. Henry, as we write in the book, as more like a military and policing protectorate for global capital and global wealth. And we get a clear sense of that by simply looking at the operation of borders. Who is allowed to go across borders, sometimes without even having their passports checked? And who for them are borders completely impenetrable? And that gives you a very clear indication into the politics of subjectivity associated with neoliberalism today. And understanding that location of power, again, forces us to have a different conversation about political emancipation. Because if power has evacuated the modern nation state, can we simply rely on electoral processes, or should we expect even electoral processes to make a change in our lives? And I guess I remain, keep a healthy suspicion around that. Now, on to then, you know, who does it benefit in terms of wealth and power? And another way of perhaps understanding this is, and this again is perhaps a different, you know, way of understanding neoliberalism, is that what marks out neoliberalism, the uniqueness of neoliberalism today, and the uniqueness in difference to economic growth in the 20th century, is that neoliberalism today thrives on catastrophe. And Naomi Klein, of course, has written about this in terms of disaster capitalism. And one of the hallmarks of neoliberalism, catastrophe is good for business. And we actually, of course, produce catastrophes now in terms of, we can talk about, you know, the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, which are clear catastrophes, which are very profitable for a whole number of people. So in that sense, to understand the wealth distribution of neoliberalism, we also cannot divorce it from the political decisions which are made in its name. And the two then therefore seem very symbiotic, or at least in strategic alliance. Now, I think another thing which also I'd like to address maybe is, when we're defining neoliberalism as a regime of power, a lot of political theorists are quite happy then to still retain a distinction between liberalism as a political project and neoliberalism. And whilst this seems to be fine for putting forward ideals around the way societies could be and the way societies could operate, in reality, liberal societies have been absorbed within a neoliberal orbit. So when we are talking about liberal societies, such as the United States of America or Great Britain, as liberal democracies, they are absorbed within a neoliberal framework. And it's to have a healthy understanding of the ways in which the logic of marketization, the reduction of life to pure economic categories, which are no less politicized, that, to me, is the start point for how we must re-engage politics today.
Is there anything more you could say about that? I was just trying to understand that a little bit.
If we start from the understanding of, as I say, of neoliberalism as a very complex regime of power, which quite clearly has winners and losers from an economic perspective, how do we then make sense of what appear to be straightforward political decisions? Now, let's look at the neoliberalization of the justification for going to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's absolutely preposterous to argue that George Bush, for instance, summoned the American troops to go into Iraq and Afghanistan for the poor people of New Orleans. How can we understand the securitization of that process? And equally, and Noam Chomsky has written about this, to wrap those adventures up in terms of the discourse of security was in itself a misnomer, because even the leading strategic thinkers at the time said, should you undergo those interventions, then the likelihood of counter-reprisals and counter-terrorist attacks are going to increase exponentially. So as Chomsky points out, this was not about security. There was a different agenda at stake. And we can paint out the resource agendas, we can paint out the colonizing agendas, and of course we can paint out the economic agendas to those processes. But ultimately, it's all about questions of power. Who controls what? And who has the right to inscribe certain forms of subjectivity? Who has the right not to inform certain types of subjectivity? How do we authenticate what is a meaningful life? And in that sense, neoliberalism does a remarkable job, actually, of reducing life and the meaning of life to some pure commodifiable purchase. And to really banalize understandings of freedom, democracy, and justice, freedom seems to be today the freedom to consume and to keep consuming, even though we know the outcome is catastrophic. But that doesn't seem to matter, because the more catastrophic it becomes, the more we can sell you temporary solutions to those catastrophes. And that is, we could argue, is nihilism par excellence. It feeds on its own catastrophe until the end, basically.
Yeah, I know we're running out of time, but there was a concept that I wanted to ask you about that you write about, and that's the doctrine of resilience. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what that is and how it's portrayed?
Mm. Yeah, the doctrine of resilience extends on from an earlier work I published called Resilient Life, The Art of Living Dangerously. And what we have found, certainly over the last 10 years, is the proliferation of the term resilience. And it very much became apparent to me, actually, while I was in New York during the 10th anniversary of the events of 9/11, how ubiquitous the term had become. And Barack Obama, in particular, enshrines resilience as a doctrine in his 10th anniversary of 9/11 speech. Now, resilience, as understood historically, has, which emanates from ecological terms, of course, refers to the ability for systems to bounce back from catastrophes or crisis, which is all well and good if we're talking about plant life and so forth, being able to be resilient to systemic changes. What I've really been interested in pursuing is, what does resilience mean politically? And how does the doctrine function politically? Now, the one thing we can start by saying is that resilience doesn't refer to some natural aptitude people have to simply bounce back in the face of catastrophe and crisis. Resilience is something which needs to be taught. So resilience points to forms of government intervention. And certain people in that sense are deemed to be more problematic than others. But also, what resilience does ultimately is it gets people to take care of themselves. So resilience is all about training people to deal with disasters in an age in which the social state will no longer protect you. So, and in that sense, the one thing which I've written about extensively is how resilience is, in many ways, coincides with the logic of austerity. There's another history to the thinking of resilience which can be traced back quite clearly to neoliberal economics, and particularly the work of Friedrich von Hayek. And resilience is, in many ways, at a political level, what we could call a neoliberal care for the self. It's the acceptance that risk is positive, that you need to embrace risk, and actually you need to expose yourself to danger, because that's a learning process which we should all embrace and all encounter. Now, there's something further beyond this which I think should raise a lot of alarm bells for us in terms of thinking about the political consequences of resilience. First of all, at a systemic level, what resilience puts forward is the inevitability or the normalization of catastrophe and the normalization of terror, for that matter. In that sense, the logical outcome of this is to set in place the fundamental assumption that modern societies are now fundamentally insecure by design. So the very idea of security actually belongs to a bygone age. And in that sense, we have to accept that insecurity is the new normal. And through that, of course, that we have to accept that sometimes just disasters are going to happen. Now, one of the consequences of this, as I mentioned previously, is that I think that this naturalization and normalization of catastrophe has profound political significance for the way we narrate catastrophes. That they're just simply something which are kind of stripped of political explanation, unless it fits the political storyline which we want to present. Now, more fundamentally, and one of the questions which I've also been compelled to ask is that, what does this mean for us at the level of individual subjectivity, in terms of if we accept that societies are fundamentally secure by design? And the inevitable outcome of this is that we actually authenticate ontologies of vulnerability. We say that all life is fundamentally vulnerable. It's born that way, and it's going to live in a perpetual state of vulnerability and anxiety. And we should embrace this, because this is just, you know, to live, as Nietzsche once said, is to forever be in danger. Now, whilst I think all of us could, you know, can rightly accept that life is finite, and certainly life is can be precarious for us, I have one thing which we talk, myself and Henry talk about in the book, is that there's something fundamentally different from saying that life is simply born naturally vulnerable to saying that life is made vulnerable through systems of oppression. And in that sense, what vulnerability can do in the category of resilience is actually flatten vulnerability. So it doesn't matter of the racial stakes or the gendered stakes or the class stakes. We're all simply vulnerable and we all need to adapt. So we're all resilient subjects in that vein. And what we put forward certainly in the Disposable Futures book is the need to move away from the naturalization of insecurity and vulnerability and look at this again from the perspective of power and ask the questions, under what conditions are people made vulnerable? Under what conditions are people made insecure? Then we can seek to address the fundamental questions around culpability, responsibility, and of course have a better insight into systems of oppression and violence in the 21st century.
Brad Evans, I want to thank you so much for talking about this and bringing your ideas to KBOO. I don't know if there's anything as we end the interview that you think's important to add or something you wanted to emphasize about our conversation.
No, it's been great having the opportunity to talk to you. One thing I would perhaps add into the discussion that we've talked about is and one of the things that we try to also warn against in the introduction, which also, I guess, permeates into contemporary discourses around environmental and ecological catastrophe today, is also, if there's any lesson to be drawn from the 20th century, it's the reduction of politics to questions of pure survivability. And one of the tragic outcomes, as we narrate throughout the book, is the once politics becomes reduced to questions of pure survivability, everything seems necessary and everything can be acted upon imminently. And perhaps we need to start also having a more acute awareness of the importance of temporalities in politics and to spend a bit more time reflecting on the significance of certainly catastrophes which frequent us, without, like the legacies of 9/11, go into war 21 days later. If, you know, if such events do truly change the face of the world and do have a profound impact on our societies, maybe we should spend just a bit more time thinking through the political and philosophical consequences of them.
Thank you. Again, I want to let people know that my guest has been Dr. Brad Evans. He is a political philosopher, critical theorist, and writer with a specialty in the problem of violence. He is the founder director of the Histories of Violence Project, and his latest book with Henry Giroux is Disposable Futures: The Seduction of Violence in the Age of the Spectacle. Again, Brad Evans, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for Political Perspectives. If you missed part of this interview with Brad Evans or want to hear it again, you can go to kboo.fm/political perspectives. Later today, it should be on our website. Thanks very much for listening, and thanks for contributing to KBOO Portland.
Good morning. That was Brad Evans talking about Disposable Futures, the Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle. And now, until the top of the hour, we have a piece from Between the Lines on racism in the presidential election.
The 2016 presidential campaign has, in the view of many Americans, hit a new low with blatant racist attacks against immigrants, Muslims, and other minorities. Some but not all of the bombast has come from Republican frontrunner, billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump. Trump refused to apologize for his failure to contest a statement from a supporter who declared that America has a Muslim problem and then went on to ask, when can we get rid of him? That episode, along with a statement from GOP candidate Dr. Ben Carson, rejecting the idea of a future Muslim U.S. president, exposed the deep veins of intolerance within the Republican Party. A September 1st PPP poll found Trump's beliefs represent the consensus among the GOP electorate, where 51% overall want to eliminate birthright citizenship, 54% think President Obama is a Muslim, and only 29% believe that President Obama was born in the U.S. Your reporter spoke with Chip Berlay, a former analyst with Political Research Associates, who has written about racism and intolerance for over four decades. Here he explains the dangers he sees in mainstream support for racism and xenophobia in today's Republican Party.
Corporate media, for the most part, just was covering the Republican primary hopefuls as a kind of sports reporting. There was no historic knowledge whatsoever. There was no reference to the outlandish bigotry of Trump, but also the bigotry of a number of the other candidates. Trump, by attracting attention as the kind of goofball, raising a lot of dust, basically overshadowed the fact that a lot of the candidates are part of the Christian right and are intensely either Islamophobic or homophobic, and many of them are anti-abortion. And so what we had for a very long time was a kind of mindless reporting of the jockeying for position without people stepping back and saying, oh my God, this is loathsome bigotry. We should stand up against that. And, you know, little by little now you're seeing more and more people writing about the fact that not just Trump, but a whole range of the Republican candidates have various forms of bigotry that I think many Americans object to.
Chip, what is your concern here in terms of this present day presidential campaign when you hear some of the hateful and bigoted rhetoric? What is the end result, you think, in our politics and in our society?
Well, the end result is violence against the named scapegoats. It's violence against our neighbors who are having targets painted on their back by these demagogues who are running in the Republican Party. And the failure, to some extent, of the Democrats and other portions of American society, you could argue that the religious community should be speaking out more. The issue here is that it's a long-standing social science theory that has been demonstrated time and time again since the Nazi genocide, that if you blame a group of people for threatening the existence of the pure ideal community, that over time some people will interpret that as a call to go either beat them up or kill them. And that has been a basic theory of social science since the Nazi genocide. I have had editors tell me, editors who I have respected over time and who have published my work, tell me when I turn in an article, we can't print that because what you're claiming is that this kind of rhetoric leads to violence, and that's biased. And it's social science isn't biased. It's a fact. You know, there are people all over the political spectrum who have proven this. And they go, well, we can't run your piece because it's biased. So it's the pushback from Fox News, but also a whole range of online right-wing, you know, basically bigoted sites that specialize in slander and degradation of some other, that editors now are afraid to even run basic social science.
What are some recent examples that we can cite here in terms of hate-filled rhetoric leading to violence? I certainly know of one, and I'm sure our listeners will remember, it wasn't just but a few weeks or a month or so ago that a couple of young white men in Boston claimed they were revved up to beat up some Latinos in their community as a result of what Donald Trump was feeding them in terms of campaign rhetoric.
Right. These are well-known hooligans in the Boston area who said to the people arresting them that it was Trump who made them move against beating up these Latino people and urinating on them, I might add, and that they were very proud of what they did. They see their arrest as a kind of a triumph of standing up ahead of the curve against these evil, degenerate forces like, oh, what's the long list, you know, Hispanics, Mexicans, Muslims, gay people, abortion providers, feminists, liberals, UN huggers. The list is very long, and it's bad enough in the mainstream media reporting these statements. But if you go online and look at some of the websites that support these candidates, it's really quite horrific what's being said. And it's bad enough what's being said in the posted articles, but the comments are astonishing. They really are calling essentially for the mass murder of whole groups of people because they're not really honestly American.
That was Chip Berlay, a longtime researcher on racism and intolerance. He's co-author with Matthew N. Lyons of the book Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort. For more views on bigotry and hateful rhetoric in the 2016 GOP nomination campaign, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. It is just a minute before the top of the hour, 10 o'clock, on a gorgeous fall day. Coming up this morning on The Boo at 10:15, it's Flashpoints, which explores the secret government of the United States with noted investigative reporter David Talbot and professor, author, investigative historian Peter Dale Scoot. And at 11 on The Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter speaks with author Janet Cascadia about her visionary novel, The Tyranny of Psychopaths. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support in our membership drive last week. If you missed it, it's not too late. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. And next up, now, we have Chris Andre, host Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary.
Cascadia.